This is October 12, 2009, part two with Kigge, and this is not going to be dealing with Kigge's biography. This is going to be Kigge the critic. He has been very critical on Five Bodied and in other forums about me, so I want to give Kigge an opportunity to explain what his problem is with me and whatever I produce. So you can begin, Kigge.
Maybe I can start with that, probably the Coker quadrant, and probably the false sense of freedom, because supposedly it's supposed to be more anarchic, or, say, going against cultural standards, if you will. Existentialism seems to be somewhat involved there. I mean, I know that Coker can get into a more objective sense and not, you know, get trapped in that, but he does come across these writers and thinkers who are basically existentialists, and I think
he does begin with Camus in some of his books.
The irony about existentialists is that supposedly they're trying to supersede these limitations, but a lot of them are like phenomenologists, you know. So
yeah.
That kind of, you know, like Heidegger, you know, it's like there's this supposed finite reality that's supposed to be subsuming this idea of eternity, but it doesn't translate. So they're thinking from these very phenomenologically, and I think this is why people are feeling very fatalistic, you know, like the personality type of the existentialist is basically the brooding, depressed type. And I think this depression is not so much as from a cynicism or becoming like a realist, but more so the inability to confront like these questions in the mind. Like, what would really happen to us if we had to deal with actual constants, actual ideas of eternity, as opposed to this nonsense called eternal recurrence, you know, from Nietzsche, which is really like a half-assed way of looking about our life in a cycle. You know, it's just...
Yeah,
you know, it's like 19th century tripping over into 20th century, but it doesn't really work.
Yeah, now, you're slightly echoing LaRouche's critique of Sartre and the existentialists with this Platonic ideal. You probably aren't limiting yourself to LaRouche, but that's what it sounds like at this point.
Well, yeah, I mean, the idea of transcendental physics is that they do at least entertain the idea that there could be a constant, and it might not necessarily be matter or energy, but it is something that is an observer, say, you know, with the quantum mechanics, you know, experiment with the slit, you know, either as a wave or a particle, and then it being changed on the observer. So I'm saying we need to fill ourselves with the idea of what actual constants are there, because I think that's going to go into Ion's world, because something about us is essentially continuous. I mean, the problem, I think, right now with media ecology is that we're becoming virgin by neglecting the material, but at the same time, we kind of get too certain in that finitude of, well, I wasn't corrupted by that bullshit, therefore I've been wiped clean, but that kind of blank slate is kind of like an existentialist kind of zero in itself. And I think the zero is like the quasi-ersatz finitude world trying to pose as the eternal transcendent. Like zero. Everyone's obsessed about zero now. But, I mean, I could say one good thing is that when you look at the chart, you see the double zero, but if you put it on its side, it's an eight. So I think the eight is a representation of our shifting from the material aspect and the Coker quadrant to a more transcendental type of becoming aware of constants. And I mean, I kind of like a little pun or, you know, here is that, you know, your wife's name means constants.
Yes.
I mean, literally. I mean, like etymologically speaking, you look at your wife's name, it means something constant, like faithful, you know, continuous.
And you pointed that out for a long time.
Well, yeah. And, well, basically, we're under the presidents of change.
Yes.
So everyone's going, I think, right now more into the single issue, right, we're about to collapse. You know, like this, there's serious implications coming in front of us, and we're thinking about our special issues to change, but we don't really have any sense of eternity outside of, we're just trying to tell other people existentially that, oh, we all have the right to be whatever we want to be, but we don't really want to look at things as how they've been as a value in itself. So, as last time I said, I'm like, I come in four parts of my political sociology as, you know, libertarian, conservative, radical, socialist. And so I think I'd have to say I'm more conservative than you in certain aspects. That would be like a starting critique, is that given that, yeah, we're not just our genetics, we're not just these prescribed
the environment,
roles.
Not just the external environment.
Right, but I would say that the roles that we do take, or we have taken in the past, serve a function, and they're not necessarily obsolete just because we found something new. Just because we found something else to do doesn't mean that the things we've done in the past is automatically obsolete.
Right.
So
I
mean, that's what I'm saying.
Right. Remember McLuhan said, when something is prominent and there's a lot of it, that's what obsolescence is. So you're saying the constant is quite plentiful, therefore it's obsolete. But you mean, you say it in the opposite way. It's not obsolete.
It's not obsolete. In fact, it's what we don't understand.
No,
it's what we don't understand, because...
Yeah. Now, let's just take that point about I don't understand, because I was going to say that the existentialist rides on the I don't know and then challenges it, but the constant in LaRouche is the I don't know. You know, Lewis is always criticizing the paradigms and models that become frozen. So wouldn't the constant be, isn't the private signal of consciousness the I don't know, the capacity to wonder?
Of the private consciousness?
Of your own.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if it is, but...
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, but they're just, it's just the depth of how they're touching it is the problem. I mean, they're private, but are they... I mean, they're taking the critical nature of just to stand out from the crowd and say, well, I'm going to look at this, I'm going to take, you know, physical reality into account, and let's actually try to get this out in the open. Yeah, that's a individualist Western conception, but where it ends is that it's like they don't have the time or the interest to, you know, discover things which are, you know, eternal, that we only think about in our mind, but we can't readily test it in the laboratory. Simply put, does eternity in any concept or any ideation in the mind exist at all? And I'm saying yes, but we kind of take that for granted. But if we dwell on that, what is that going to make us look about how we perceive our world and how we interact with it, as opposed to matter? But maybe there's a lot more consciousness involved that we're kind of putting to the side, because we're saying, well, you know, when you die, you're just dead, and, you know, it's, you black out. But I'm saying, as a transcendentalist, that, sure, your nerves are gone, your personality is gone, everything you can ever conceive of yourself is gone. And, you know, it's a very numb, probably, existence, if you want to speak about it empirically, because people have their nerves cut off and they don't feel anything. But the you, and, you know, we may get, like, you know, religious or philosophical or metaphysical, say, okay, yeah, you're a teardrop, and then you go into the great ocean of the non-ego, and then you're something else. I'd like to agree and disagree at the same time. I think there is something essentially individual about us, and that to an appearance, yeah, we do go into this greater ocean, but that we don't recognize that eternity in ourselves, and we think it's just going to pass over when we die. You know, and I think that's what we got to concentrate on, because those realities are inside us. I think they're with us, but we've never really looked at the human being in like a totalistic sense. I mean, we have chemistry, we have neurology, we have atomic scientists, we look at electromagnetism, but I don't think we really peered through deep enough. And so I have to disagree with the existentialists, because their imitation of the transcendental eternal is very cheap. You know, like, I think eternal recurrence is, like, a disgustingly absurd idea that people want to continually entertain themselves with that because it sounds intelligent or because it fits into their little logic circuit. But it's absurd. And it's so, why does this seem so natural to me, you know, and to some people it's totally absurd? I think it's really, there's culture influences it as well, you know. So maybe I'm at that divide between Eastern and Western culture, but not in a very New Age kind of hipster sense, but just simply I've lived on the border, and I'm looking at everyone arguing about this, and I'm thinking, well, we're wasting a lot of time here. So, you know, we should talk about what is it when we die? What does Ion say about when we die? I mean, that's what I'd like to start critiquing about our essences and how it relates to culture. What does Ion say about when we die?
Right. Before I go into that, remember, you're criticizing me, but you're talking about Croker. I'm not Croker.
Well, I mean, more so in the sense that the idea of the basic media ecology, at least how it was, like, say, early 90s, mid-90s, shut your television off, lose...
Croker. That was McLuhan. Croker was not that.
Well, the odd numbers seem to reappear, you know, because, like, you have, I mean, McLuhan introduced the tetrad posthumously. He thought about it, and it was introduced by his son, but, you know, you place him as a triad, and I think that's rightfully so, because he is a more of an edgier thinker than, say, Croker or Thompson, who just kind of just seep into the equilibrium, if you will. Probably, like, I wouldn't say water is an appropriate metaphor, but it's too equal, and therefore it doesn't have a contrasting type of approach perceptually. So, I mean, you're somewhat contrasting. I mean, you place yourself as the pentad. I mean, even though, like, presently hexadic and so on, but, I mean, that's where you say as an art form for us to interpret to you as before, you know, we even approach that idea of the mystery landscape and those life-giving realities, hexad via Connie, if you will, just as an analogy. So you have LaRouche, but the odd thing about the one is that it is an oddity, but of all the oddities, it's most uniform. So LaRouche kind of, you know, he attacks these empirical assumptions and these counterculturists, but then he kind of seeks an equilibrium because he's at the beginning area of the noumenon, the mind, the, you know, the mental body. So, but we see that, you know, each of these characters, from their private perspective, they overlap into the other. For example, as you'd say, Thompson really is operating from the triadic level, and McLuhan really is operating from the tetradic level, and
yeah,
you know, and Croker, you know, operating from the pentadic level, you know, ecologically speaking, as where
I work from the hexadic level, which
correct,
is Mr. Landscape,
yeah,
which is Connie.
Right. So we're moving between this oddness, between this perceptual challenge and just being equilibrium with the environment. And I'm saying, what is going to be the odd and the even in this is we're going to have to understand some eternal sense of the self as a soul and what that is composed of. Because my mission, or at least my entertainment in my mind, my hobby, is discovering what it would take to resurrect the dead. So we're talking about, well, you know, you die, Ion says, well, we live in this, you know, post-technology rally, just, you know, think it, will it, thought be done. Sure, that's really interesting. It may be theoretically true in some sense, but I am the type of person that I have to take my own hands and literally do the thing myself, you know, and write it down, you know, translate it into human language and give this knowledge to other. Prometheus, not bound. Prometheus, faithful, is what I'm saying. So I think, I mean, we probably couldn't even conceive of the idea of the septatic level right now, neither of us, or any of us, right? Because that supposedly wouldn't even have to exist because we have, like, some finite crystal-like structure here. But what I would say is the septatic, which is, you know, the ground of, say, this mystery landscape, the hexadic, was that in the hexadic level, we're trying to be bound to these things that we want, you know, the sense of immortality, the sense of second and first nature fusing. So we have a lot of fusion. It's very, it's an equal type equilibrium. You know, we want to reconcile everything. That's why Hexatic has always been speaking of, okay, we're extremely organic, we're discarnate, and we're also more than discarnate, and we're new AP as opposed to old AP. But I'm saying the Symptatic is, the Septatic would be fidelity as a word. And I would call the Hexatic bond, you know? So we're bound to things, but we not necessarily be mindful of them. So when we are faithful to the idea of eternity as a concept, then we see what we're really composed of. I mean, so what I'm bringing back is kind of, yeah, like a Laurentian-type Platonism, but it's also kind of like related to like Hindu-type Krishnamurti. Well, actually, I'd say post-Krishnamurti because I think he's actually almost a phenomenologist in the way he like these language abstractions that he thought were very profound. But I'm talking about, you know, Vedic type knowledge of that we are eternal. Something about us is eternal, and that's what I'm trying to emphasize. And that's, we have to like learn to look at those properties as opposed to, you know, we're dead, fuck it, think it. I don't think so. I want to extract that reality, that eternity, to find that eternity and focus it somewhere.
Yeah, that's definitely Ion territory. Ion says that that Elvis, when he died, and Ion says every death is a suicide, just most people don't leave a suicide note, or it's hard to find their suicide note. It is usually in the circumstances that they passed on with is their suicide. So Elvis apparently moved on, but he didn't go to the Guff. He went to a parallel world. So Ion is announcing this secret knowledge that there are these parallel worlds one can go to rather than the Guff. But most people end up in the Guff, and you go there rather instantly, and everybody is equal in the Guff. There's no karma. There's no nothing about what you've done. And to the degree the Guff is conscious, it celebrates everybody. It rejoiced at Hitler because he asserted his own individuality. They rejoice at Henry VIII, rejoice at everybody. But now, maybe not everybody, because they hate wimps, but they don't care. They understand, the Guff understands, and that's us when we're there, understands that we come here to create contrast. And what's interesting about Ions, they define tactility as contrast, and that's very interesting. Way of looking at it, because McLuhan said that tactile surfaces are represented by hard bounding lines, so there's your contrast. Soft lines, soft surfaces merging to other surfaces is visually biased, comes through literacy. So contrast could be a good way to define tactility. So we come here to celebrate tactility and enjoy contrast. And non-physical, the Guff zone, doesn't create anything. It can know everything. It can observe, I guess. So what happens to the person, to the soul? I'm still working on that, but a new wrinkle I've got on it from Ion is that when the something that's there, which is maybe your eternal thing, is in the Guff, it decides that it's rather bored with the Guff, and it wants to go into the physical and mix it up. It shows up, takes a ticket, and waits in line, so to speak. Says, I'm available. And then Ion uses the concept, metaphor of a glass is scooped in the ocean. And that liquid that's in the glass may have aspects of Napoleon, aspects of your father, aspects of anybody. And they will be what you will be made up of. So you don't know what you're going to consist of. You're just saying, I want to be filled, scoop the water, and put it in me. And who knows what will be in there. So let me just finish the basic map. Then he says, when you're born, as you experience your life, there's always unpredictable stuff as a result of the mixing it up. And you may, you might have a plan, but it's going to go awry or be altered once you're here in existence. The other important fact is that today, if we have a lot of people die in this desperate time, like the Bible predicts, there will be more people on the planet as a result of that. The interesting thing that Ian pointed out is that when they had the Black Plague in the 1300s, it actually wasn't for 3 years, it was for 100 years, there were so many babies born after that, that really launched what we know as the Renaissance. So it's not going to wipe out the population, it's going to create more babies. And the reason that is that when a person dies, whatever they never got to create, and they're mixing it up in this tactile, contrasting environment, is poured into the guff. And the next soul that's going to be born will ride on those unrealized creations. And so many people are going to die now, and a lot of people want to die now. That's their passive path of joy, and they will die. There'll be so many unrealized creations going to the guff that the young kids coming through, the new souls, when they're born, will be very creative because they'll be riding in on such a huge abundance of unrealized creations. Now, those are interesting thoughts. I don't think anybody's ever heard that said before. And Ion said it, and that's what I'm mentioning. So you can respond to those early mappings.
Well, let's say, you know, ecology is like a house, right? And we're living in this house, and it's a great big cosmic house. And you have a communal house, and then you have the dyadic slash separate house, which would be kind of like the fragmented version of visual space and objectivism. And then you have, the mixed house, which is standing between the individuality and the non-ego. And what I'm saying is, personally, that I think all three conceptions are important. Especially, I mean it more beyond just a moral or spiritual sense. I also mean it in the sense of intelligence or just being able to apply yourself to whatever you need at that time. And so what I have to say to the guff about them not liking wimps and about their nihilistic kind of, I don't know, communal reality.
But that's not a
reality.
That's the whole point.
We don't know whether it's good.
Wait a minute. You don't want to build on that thought. I said that, but the guff doesn't think anything. The guff doesn't care. I was just pointing out that the people that this world think is evil and have terrible karma and all that, not true.
Mm-hmm.
And they point out that the heavens rejoice at what Hitler did.
I'm ambivalent about that. I'm not actually trying to criticize the guff on that level. I mean on a different conception.
Okay.
Meaning the idea of why us as human beings on this earth thinking back out from the guff and where we're going to go, I'm thinking more in an ambivalent sense, and that's why I had to divide it into a trinity. And so what I'm saying here is that I'm not a cosmic thinker. I'm an acosmic thinker. So you have these cosmic compartmentalization of the guff, our mortal life here, you and I, and
other worlds,
the parallel worlds. So what I'm saying is I'm trying to look for an eternity that translates in all of those realms, and I know instinctually it exists. I can't prove it, but that's just the life of my mind. And what I'm saying here is the idea of weakness, what we don't, or wimpness, we really don't know what that is, because there's some irony here, some Manichean satire involved.
Yep.
Because the dead. Who's really the dead, and what is it about the dead? Who's dead? And I'm saying, I've in my earlier life, very left hemispheric mode, whether it's the industrial mode or the printed objectivist mode, or even whichever flavor you want to call it. And me lately switching over this right hemispheric mode, I'm not going to get caught up in that either, just because I know that this is more empowering. At the same time, I do know that, in this quadrant that I have, this sociological quadrant that, anthropologists look at about polygyny, which is one male with many females, and the ratio goes like equality between men and men and competition between women and women decreases polygyny, and competition between men and men and equality between woman and woman increases polygamy. And what I'm saying, what, of course, I already told you, is the most important element is the sisterhood. Now, if we cannot create that equality on the idea of the tangible world, which is very fragile, meaning here, the physical world, which I can probably describe in old anthropomorphic sense, is that I really don't care about the guff or the parallel worlds, because the sisterhood is most essentially a sisterhood in the face of adversity in the fragile universe, which is where we are. We are in the fragile, tangible, transient existence right now in our mortal life. And this is one of the three important conceptions. And so what I'm saying is some of these right hemispheric masculine energies, probably this communal entity in the guff, has this very strong right hemispheric masculine presence of, okay, let's just be equalize this and let's, you know, not sweat the small stuff and create this group consciousness, and we'll just be all reborn as these great revolutionaries in the lover another lifetime or whatever, because we deserve it or whatever. We'll just put it in our little cosmic computer. What I'm saying is I don't care about the cosmic computer. That's not important. What's important is the idea of how an individual can conceive of eternity within themselves. So what I'm actually going through is I'm saying that some modern forms of Satanism, in at least its cosmological view of matter and energy and consciousness, at least on the basic level of where we are as individuals, can actually be more humane and just than some of the New Age shit that I've come across, whether you'd call it, you know, Buddhism or Theosophy or, you know, Christianity. And that's because they're coming across a more deeper realism, because that tradition was lost, the idea of the acosmic. And so I'm saying, even as myself, as an entity, perhaps I don't have that transcendence as those in the guff, but I feel as a personal individual, I have the right to discover that sense of eternity within myself. So I'm not even going to care about someone philosophizing to me about, well, it's all being processed. I don't even care about the media ecological sense, because I don't care about the house and how the logic is divided upon it. I am a non-quantum thinker who realized that these right hemispheric masculine perspectives, we live in a world of monkey see, monkey do. So what I'm saying here is, like, just think about it. Yeah, Austrian men have more sexual partners than most of the industrialized West, perhaps the most. But what about their women? The question is that of the opposite, of the contrast between the two. If you push hard on the other side, for the general part, it makes the other side more in acquiescence to that, for the general. So yeah, women who are in the presence of right hemispheric masculine energy tend to go towards the left hemispheric feminine energy. But that's not the completion in the process, because even though they're pushed aside, whether genetically, culturally, or psychologically, there's still another element involved, which is how they see the order around them or the purpose. Therefore, and to sum it up very quickly, if you act chaotic, others will begin to emulate you and act chaotic. So I'm coming back to a bilateral approach, just to keep that fidelity in perspective. So my bilateral approach is, I'm not going to go fly to the guff. I'm not going to fly to the parallel worlds. My job is to take the thread in all of that cosmic reality and pull it and rupture it, and to cause an orderly form of chaos, which is inevitably going to go towards intelligence, which is what we lack, which is because we lack the fire. We don't have real fire anymore. All we have is these empty media experiences through the internet, which is supposedly apocalyptic. We're all networking behind each other, but I feel like the internet itself is a new expression of the Oedipus. The Oedipus is online. We're walking around in a shadow, and it's network, and supposedly we're going through these great libertarian sense of freedom, but we're just clicking clicking and clicking and clicking and clicking. And that's what I think the problem with the 90s and this decade, the knots, you know, the nihilism, is that we're not coming across that. So I'm saying I have to, as a thinker, just as a flaw, I have to purposely extract from people around me their statements. It has to be translated back to here, because I, as I said, I'm the stubborn Faust. So we have to look at this conception of eternity, because all of these particulated realities, oh, it's sorted out, it doesn't matter. I'm trying to resurrect the dead. So meaning if there is a capacity to literally take one's hands and surge it through the guff and pull something down, it's definitely worth it. And I'm saying that's the difference between the acosmic mind and the cosmic mind. I'm not going to have the structure, the crystal, make me wait. Waiting is a form of fatalism. So that's where I'm disagreeing on the sixth part of the chart, is that I'm not waiting for anything. Okay. I'm only waiting for, you know, day to day. So,
you know what Ion would say to all that you've said, the part you've quoted different ideas but asserted your view within that, they would say perfect words, because everything you've said, as I understand Ion, is what Ion says. Ion does not recommend the Abraham's thing of 1-2-3-ing, manifesting and then waiting. Ion says don't wait, 3-2-1 it. So that's the new factor. You can hear me talk about that on the March 25th cash flow thing. Reconciling the eternal to yourself, Ion calls out the relationship between you and you, is exactly what Ion says, and you said that. Everything you said is what Ion's about. Now, there's a couple of points here, images you have of the guff that may not be accurate, as I understand what Ion.
Well, I'm a superstitious person, so I might have superstitious beliefs, but, you know, I was kind of raised in that kind of, like, shaman what-ifs. I have a lot of what-ifs. That's probably what's limiting me, but I take a little bit of the paranoia perspective. Like, supposedly I'm emulating five bodies, and one of them is paranoia.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you have the schizophrenia and the hysteria and the panic and
Well, that's part of the mixing it up. That's one of the...
Yeah, the paranoia is... Don't knock the paranoia, because the paranoia gets us guarded. And as one of my favorite, you know, political philosophers said, who's also a psychoanalytical philosopher, Slavoj Zizek, he says, the death instinct isn't like all these, you know, pitiful, you know, existentialist thinkers who think it's an erotic, narcissistic desire to extinguish oneself, the death instinct. No, he says, the true death instinct has nothing to do with coming towards death, accepting death, or depravedly, sadistically enjoying death. No, the true conception of the death instinct is the radical inner it surfacing, you know, through ego to superego, our will to live. And if we lie to ourselves saying, there's definitely ecology, we look at the earth, we see things in cooperation. And that's what I'm actually trying to create, is a cooperation, a sisterhood in this fragile planet, and trying to grab out that ephemeral, eternal consciousness in eternity and bring it back to the physical world.
That's exactly what Ion says. Exactly.
Right. But what I'm saying as my perspicacious spin on this is that I have the death instinct to be willing to cause violence. And that's essentially what... Most animals that are of any type of intelligence have defense mechanisms that are wired into their body, their being. And that's what we're losing the instinct of in media ecology, because we think it's a defense mechanism to not be brainwashed by the mainstream culture and just shut off, but we're not having the death instinct to be paranoid, to think, what if this is not enough? To where I have to literally not think about it and be idealistic about it, because I don't think idealism and transcendentalism are the same thing. They're very similar, but they're not. And I'm saying I'm trying to focus that death instinct against the cosmic order. So it may seem like a Gnostic conception, like we have this kind of vague good and evil that's floating on different sides, the demiurge and, you know, God and the devil, and we're hopping between the two, and matter and spirit's divided. I don't say that at all. I think the vagueness is ever-present, and it doesn't have to do of whether our physical or spiritual nature, more so that it's just an entity. So I'm saying evil, I mean, if we look at our religious history, and we probably have one just bit of decency to ourselves, just to respect these people as living in their time instead of being cynical about our time, just as thinkers of their time, you know, that, yeah, there was a war in heaven. And how we're going to conceive of that, you know, it was spoken about as, you know, a third of the angels were cast down as lightning. So that's a metaphor, but they're like poets. And I think that's what's constantly going on right now. So when I hear about Gulf and the parallel world, I'm not giving judgments about this is the good place, that's the bad place, or good bad things happening here. But that our battle, our death instinct has to be continuously, just as a right brain male has to be reached in every direction. So I'm saying I can't take someone else's word for it. So I looked on the internet, you know, about bodies and what changes when they die. And I was just curious to come across a Polish physicist, Janusz Sławiński, just saying how a dead body emits about 1,000 times greater the bioelectric/ionic energy than a body at a resting state. So maybe
just an aside, I asked Ion about that statistic. I had it in my notes. I think it was last night. It said, do we release 1,000 ions when we transition?
Or 1,000 times greater than our usual resting state, is what I meant to say.
Yeah, okay, maybe. I said 1,000 ions or something. He says, no, it's millions. So maybe that's
what. So it's probably even greater.
Yeah, it's great. A lot. A lot is released.
So I'm looking for what's released from us. So what are we releasing? I mean, maybe that's what I agree with, is that there is something ecstatic about the pentatic level. X.
Yeah.
And that we've had this stasis, and so we see it released. And so that gives us an idea of, in a sense, of eternity. So you have the two zeros, and that's eternity. So that's getting us out of the grid, the box, the Croker box.
Yeah. So the Ion says that when you transition, or, quote, die, and it always says there is no death, you go right into the bliss of the Gulf immediately, and that's that. You're there. And then after a while, you get this urge. Now, what is it that's getting the urge? See, that's the nebulous part. What is it that's conscious in the Guff or has some kind of individual direction? Now, I can understand that we can't experience the Guff until we get there. So we have, inadequate feeling places about it. But Ian has said, you know, when you get on mescaline or something like that, you get 1/10 of what it's like to be in the Guff. But it's an approximation. It'll give you an inkling from this position. So Ion says that everybody goes to the Guff. So you can, that's a given. Ion says the non-physical is a factor in life, and it can't create, but it would like to facilitate and cooperate with what you're trying to do in the physical, which it's all for. From Ion's point of view, Ion, which is just zillions of dead entities or transitioned entities, their view is create more worlds and keep doing it and mixing it up. And all the contrasts and screw-ups that come from it, that's good, too. So that is the perspective when you're, quote, stoned in the Guff. But then when you come here, you feel different, right?
Yeah. You feel panic. I mean, humans are in a state of panic. I mean, we know that we die. We've been dying.
Right. Now, you can, though, realize there's nothing to panic about because where you'll go when you leave here is a wonderful place. So then you can relax. So Ion is advocating putting a spark in people to kind of prove to them there is a non-physical, and then that cools them out. And then they can play with the contrast that's natural here, the natural tactility, easier, and maybe create better, create more amazing stuff. Ion is not impressed. He would agree with you. He's not impressed with this clicking world we have. He's not impressed with our technology. Many civilizations have had more incredible technology, and a lot of that technology was done by people who didn't make anything. They just could imagine themselves into new dimensions because they didn't have any concepts about what they were. I was asked talking about cavemen last night, and I said, so does the caveman, or does anybody, but we were talking about cavemen, when he transitions into guff, does he still have a kind of arm and leg? And does he have a sensation? Because Ion had been saying it was very similar from being here to when you're there. And Ion said, well, the caveman doesn't know it has a hand and leg or foot when it's here in the physical. Those are images that have been developed through culture or media, and the caveman has no images of itself. And when it dies, it's like such a subtle shift, it doesn't even know it died. Though if you go into the guff, you must feel something different. Ion does sort of say something is different there, but it's very subtle. So you actually are talking like a caveman. That's not a put-down, just that you're expressing caveman original.
How about we say Neanderthal, because I consider them a potential species that were lost before their time.
Right, they were the ones that didn't get mutated by the Boudians. The other ones did, and they the other thread of ape, and they became what was called Cro-Magnon, whereas the Neanderthals died out.
But they did have larger brain cavities, and what I feel in common with them is that they had a higher caloric intake, and I guess that's my aggressive, predatorial realities that, I need more. I need more. I'm not going to eat vegetables like the Cro-Magnons. I am a hunting ice Siberian.
Well, they didn't even
cynic.
They didn't think in those terms. They didn't know. I asked.
They didn't have to think. They just thought and felt it seamlessly, and that was their reality.
And in a way, they manifested whatever they want. They 3-2-1 did. I asked about their herbal knowledge. And they went into, the caveman ate anything. So it was very eating herbs, but didn't know it, just was eating whatever could be eaten. And it was, by fact, helping their bodies. But the caveman did not know why, did not know it was. And I said, if you're walking around and you're cutting your feet, how do you handle that? And they said, the cavemen walked around their bare feet so long, they had such thick skin that their feet didn't get cut. Which is obvious, right? I hadn't thought of it when I was just bringing up the point. Did they know they had sore feet when it got bitten or something? No. The skin was so thick, they didn't notice it. So, and that's parallel to what they said about the homeless, or a certain kind of sensibility in the homeless, or just living like cavemen.
Well, perhaps the Neanderthal's problem was that the male was too involved in the right hemispheric reality,
but those are terms we make. Those aren't useful to the condition you aspire to.
Well, I agree and I disagree. I agree because we're on something different here, but I disagree because their mating structure was entirely different from us, and so is their social. I mean, we hunted them out, is basically what I'm saying. I mean, us as Cro-Magnon Z evolution, as we call ourselves, we're repeating ourselves in the way that we relate to our technology by proxy, like our little sexual organ that goes out and does for us, and we sit passively, So I'm saying, the Neanderthal had more spirit, and they had a different type of intelligence, and since they didn't get into the groove of that type of militaristic discipline as the Cro-Magnons, they didn't survive when they were starved out and hunted out by the Cro-Magnons on the Iberian Peninsula. But what I'll say here is that there was possibly intermingling. I mean, for the longest time, it was considered extremely implausible, and it would be a joke. But, I mean, they're coming across some slight genetic evidence that there might have been a very small breeding period, but it has come down into our genetic line that we have, quote-unquote, Neanderthal genes.
The Neanderthals weren't human. The Cro-Magnon were, and that's the big difference. Well, everything else is not human, and they don't make it with us.
I don't. Well, that doesn't actually preclude things from happening. Actually, you can interbreed species. Actually, but the thing is, what I'm saying here is that our military and our militaristic culture in this nation state kind of replicates that Cro-Magnon belief. They say that monogamous societies are basically better at warfare. I mean, you can look that up as an anthropological survey yourself and go look it on the internet and see who wrote it. It'll probably be a reputable name enough. And I think that's because men who take orders and are in formation are great, mindless masses of destruction. And that's what we are as the left hemispheric male in our corporate culture and our great clicking technology. And so the right hemispheric warrior is more personable and more on the terrain level, and so he's more qualitative to his wartime needs. But I'm saying I'm not fighting someone else's war, therefore I don't really care about these Bootsian experiments, because as far as we know, they were probably experiments on other extraterrestrials. Like, so we were experimenting on. Who experimented on the aliens is what I'm saying, and I'm sure it happened. I'm sure they're experimenting with themselves. And I'm sure they have debates about whose civilizational structure is superior, and they're fighting right now. I'm sure we've been given an idea of, yeah, they're agreeing with each other, sure. I mean, at some certain state, we all barter even with our former enemies, and we don't have to fire a gunshot. But the point is, I don't believe that this discontinuity is like, that this Bootsian creator is my god. I mean, thanks for the... thanks for the present planet Earth, but, I think that the scape would become even larger than that, and that in some other scenario, you would probably find a Neanderthal-like species who was modified for their ascendancy in some other part of, our galaxy. And so that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't care. I'm acosmic. I don't care if who gave me the gift or... It's more like the intelligence in and of itself, and I think that our assumptions of Neanderthals are wrong because of our own anthropological bias, because it represents our own desires and our replication that we go through.
Okay,
so,
do you think there is time?
I mean, they have... Do I think there's time?
Yeah.
In the larger aspect of coming to conclusions through when you talk to yourself as like a metaphysician, I would say no. And that would, I would say no.
Okay.
Larger.
Ion would agree with you, but I think it also would include the little. Ion is very adamant that there is no time. And physicists are now, the advanced physicists are starting to notice it in their measurements and also noticing parallel worlds in their terms. And this is bothering them because all of science is based on time, which in McLuhan terms is an effective literacy. And Ion agrees with McLuhan on that point, that the calendar really caused a problem for humans and created the crust and veil, thickening of the veil. And now it's thinning, but that's natural because of the post-literate technology, but also for geophysical reasons. Reasons interesting is Zappa did that whole thing on Gregory Peccary and satirized the little pig that made the calendar. So Zappa was trying to work with time, and I talked to Zappa through Ion, but I don't want to get distracted on that, but Zappa was trying to figure out how to deal with time. So you think there's time on the local level, though, in your local experience?
Somewhat, yeah. But, that's just for general purposes of utility.
Right, and that is what Ion critiques. We could get a lot more done on the local level, or whatever this level is, if we gave up the idea of time completely. And then you would, when you go to parallel worlds, you can go over there and spend 3 weeks, and it's only 10 minutes here. And so as you get proficient going back and forth in the worlds, then the time issue becomes negligible, So, and also Ion says that we are slipping into the other worlds all the time anyways. We're not aware of it. And that's what's interesting is Ion points out things that happened to me on the walk to the beach, and they're very strange. But they make sense within the flipping between worlds phenomena. A lot of this is going to happen more and more to people consciously because the veil has thinned, and that's why ION is the most avant-garde information on how we would resurrect the dead. So your project of doing that has to take into consideration the changing of the relationship between us and the dead, how vampires are coming into reality now. It's a fad among whoever, young people or something. But
to what degree? I'd like to touch upon that, maybe.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because I think the first nomenclature for you, when I first met you by email in 2000 or so, you were the Vampire Church, right?
Yeah, which is a Northwest thing.
Yeah, right. No, vampires are real, and more and more people are adopting that position as the thinning of the veil happens. See, now that there's, in a way, the guff is all filled up, though it's not exactly that. There's continuous expansion, but it doesn't have to be expansion in the guff. It expands here. And so the division between the non-physical and the physical is becoming thin. So our definitions of phenomena that are either on one side or the other are sort of filling in the gap of that as the difference between the two realms disappears. Now, that's not for everybody. You can create the guff. I mean, you can create the a thick veil. You can imagine that you're stuck here and there's nowhere else to go, and that would happen for you. But the opportunity for those who don't want to be limited to that experience, or to have that kind of experience, we don't want to say it's limited, is now available.
So, to what degree do we say that these vampires exist? To what level? What are we saying?
They're happening. People are becoming vampires.
As in the sense that they sustain off the blood, or just...
Yeah, they do the vampire myth.
As a metabolism, that it sustains them?
Yeah.
And does that give them any type of...
Doesn't give them any advantage, it's just what they want to be. It might be a resolution of the problem of their resonance between the you and the you in them, or the self and the other self, because there's two of everything. And then there's two of those doubles. And what's interesting is that's why I sent you those YouTubes, Buzz took the themes that I emphasized on the episode Lost, Warehouse 13, Eureka, Fringe, Flash Forward, and Doctor Who, that they are in the popular culture now, the last few years, and they're directly reflecting the thinning of the veil, but they're putting paranoid spins on it. They're making people think, gee, if I'm like Olivia Dunham in Fringe and I go over the other side, if I come back, I won't know who I was or am, and I'll be bruised and all that. So in a way, the Android meme is keeping up with what Bob's exploring and reflecting back on it and trying to make it paranoid, hysterical, panicky, or schizophrenic. Now, with ION's view, though, that's okay that the Android meme does that, and the TV body should express contrast, that's okay. But you have to figure that out in your relationship to that. Most people are reacting, just reacting. And so we have the new phenomenon of the undead, the people who cannot think, cannot complete a thought because there's nothing to think about because everything is thought for you, and those thinkings in the Android meme are canceled. I was talking about this on the last cash flow. I think that's in one of the... Buzz makes YouTubes really quickly from these shows, so I think one of the YouTubes I posted is dealing with that segment I talked about, the undead, the inability to create. Now, we are creators regardless, and ION's all for us creating and interacting with contrast and mixing it up, but we have this external environment to the degree you're clicking and interacting with it. You look up what is the take on red wine, does it cure cancer or not, and there's studies supporting both sides, then you don't know what to think about it. So you either give it up and say, the heck with it, I'll make my own version of red wine, my own reaction. And ION is for that. So
or how about
just
sociological realities? Probably no one would care to listen to it, but I am the conservative reactionary.
No, listen, what you were just saying, I was just going to say that ION is a libertarian, conservative, radical socialist. Isn't that what you are?
Yeah.
That's ION. That is ion. And I've done over 500 hours with ion, so you know I'm in a privileged position of knowing the nuances of how it talks and all the strange things it does in reaction to me and Carolyn. So, you know, it's unfair for me to cite this, but if you ever had the chance to hear this stuff, you would come to a similar conclusion probably. Because I found it very interesting that you're emphasizing the constant and the transcendent, but not in the platonic and all these regular cultural terms that are the ideal as passed on. That is not what you mean, and Ion agrees. He says, Ion, the Christians talk about God, but they got God upside down. They don't know what God is. And so your questioning of these terms but remaining, quote, conservative is appropriate. Now, the hexadic, on the chart, you have, that's 1960 to 1990, and then we had the after image up till 2008 or so. It predicts moving into hexad. And the hexad is the mystery landscape and becoming aware of aspects of it. And definitely ion is a product of the hexadic. And so the constants aspect is interesting as the hexadic, and ion is part of it. So I don't know if you need to have a septadic because there's no measurement in the hexadic, so you wouldn't know. You could say you're already into the 12th level.
Only because I've come across a lot of probes that repeated themselves, and I contrasted it with the 6 and the 7, and the 7 was just enough to get me over... the water.
You could say it's always 7, because if you say it's 6 and hexadic, that's a category, that's not what we're talking about.
Right.
Any category fails. So to cancel any category, say you're 7, but you might as well use an 8 on its side. You know, you can say you're on the 8 level. So the chart, the Tino chart and the formula chart are very transitory and ephemeral and quantum fluctuations, but they probably are the best way to use categories if you bring in the five bodies. Today, to the degree you need those categories, or it's even a concern.